How long have they been here?
This was their first season.
She said, please fix our car now.
That's why I'm here, Carol said.
He opened the Honda's hood with deft and practiced movements. He leaned forward and held the new black box down low, as if trying it for size. Then he backed off an inch and squinted, as if trying to get a better look. He extricated himself and stood up straight. He said,
actually, your relay is in good shape.
Patty said, then why won't it start?
Must be a different problem.
Carol put the black box with the disconnected wires back in his pocket. He shuffled around the fender and approached from a different angle.
Try the key one more time, he said. I want to hear how dead it is.
Shorty got in behind the wheel and flipped the key. On, off, click, click, click. Carol said,
okay, I get it.
He shuffled a full 180, all the way around to the opposite fender, and he bent down again, where the battery was bolted into a skeletal cradle. He stuck his face right down and twisted his neck so he could see underneath. He brought his hand down and felt with his fingertip. Then he backed out and straightened up and stood still for a second. He glanced at the woods, and then the other way, at room 12's corner. He stepped out until he could see beyond it, to the barn and the house. He came back and shooed Patty and Shorty up on their boardwalk, over toward their door, looking back all the time as he came, as if checking they were all safely out of some theoretical line of vision. He said, quietly,
did any of these guys work on your car?
Peter did, Shorty said.
Why?
He said he looked after the quad bikes, so we asked him to take a look.
He doesn't look after the quad bikes.
Did he screw it up? Carol looked left and right.
He cut the main positive feed coming out of the battery.
How? By accident?
Not possible by accident, Carol said. It's a pure copper wire thicker than your finger. You would need a big pair of pliers with a wire cutter blade. It would take some strength. You would definitely know you were doing it. It would be an act of deliberate sabotage.
Peter had a pair of pliers. Yesterday morning, I saw him.
It's like disconnecting the battery completely. Zero electrical activity anywhere. The vehicle is paralyzed, which is exactly your symptom.
I want to see, Shorty said. Me too, Patty said. Carol said, look underneath. They took it in turns, leaning deep over the engine bay, ducking down, twisting their necks. They saw a stiff black wire, clearly chopped in half, the ends displaced, the cut faces gleaming as fresh as new pennies. They walked back to where Carol was standing. He said,
I'm sorry, but I don't know what to tell you. I don't really know these guys very well. I have to assume this was their idea of a practical joke, but it's a really stupid one. It won't be cheap to fix. That kind of wire is almost rigid. It's like plumbing. You have to remove a whole bunch of other components just to get near it.
Don't fix it, Patty said. Don't even think about it. Just get us out of here this minute. Give us a ride right now.
Why?
It wasn't a practical joke. They're keeping us here. They won't let us leave. We're like prisoners.
That sounds pretty weird.
But it's true. They're stringing us along. Everything they tell us is lies.
Like what?
They said we were the first guests in this room. But I don't think we are.
That's totally weird.
Why?
There were people in this room a month ago. I know that for sure, because I had to bring a tire to a guy in room 9.
They said you were their good friend.
That was the second time I ever met them.
They implied they had been here at least 3 years.
That's not right. They showed up a year and a half ago. There was a big fight over a building permit.
They said their phone was out yesterday, but I bet it wasn't. They just wanted to keep us here.
But why would they? Money?
We thought of that, Shorty said. We were about to run out. Anyone would run out sooner or later. Then what would they do?
This is very weird, Carol said.
He stood there, uncertain.
Please, give us a ride, Patty said. Please, we have to get out of here. We'll pay you $50.
What about your car?
We'll leave it here. We were going to sell it anyway.
It wouldn't be worth much.
Exactly. We don't care what happens to it, but we've got to go. We have to get out, right now, this minute. You're our only hope. We're prisoners here.
She stared at him. He nodded, slowly. Then again, taking charge. He stepped back and looked left and right, craning over both his shoulders. He glanced at his giant truck and the dimensions of the lot, measuring it, scoping it out. And then he glanced into the room, at the neat arrangement of luggage.
Okay, he said. Time to arrange a jailbreak.
Thank you, Patty said.
But first, I need to ask an embarrassing question.
What?
Did you pay your bill? I would get in trouble if I helped you skip out in secret. There are innkeeper laws here.
We paid last night, Shorty said. We're good until noon.
Okay, Carol said. So let's think for a minute. We should err on the side of caution. We should assume the worst case. We don't know how they're going to react to this. Therefore, it's probably better if they don't see it happening. Agreed?
Much better, Patty said.
So you guys stay out of sight while I turn the truck around so it's facing in the right direction. Then you guys grab your bags and hop on board and away we go. By which time, nothing will be able to stop us. Even a Mercedes-Benz would bounce right off. Okay?
We're good to go, Shorty said. Carol looked in the door at the suitcase.
That's pretty big, he said. Can you lift it? Want me to come back and help?
I can do it.
Show me. A delay could screw this up.
Patty went in first. She picked up the overnight bags, one in each hand, and stood out of the way, so Shorty could get to the main attraction. He wrapped both fists around the new rope handle and hauled, and the case came up 6 inches in the air. Carol watched from the doorway, as if judging. He said,
"How fast can you move with it?"
"Don't worry," Shorty said. "I won't screw up." Carol looked at him, and then at Patty, she with a small bag in each hand, he with the big bag in both, the two of them standing there side by side in the space between the bed and the AC. He said,
"Okay, wait there, and don't come out until I get turned around." Then Patty comes out first. She throws the small bags up in the cab and climbs in after them. Then Shorty comes out and boosts the suitcase up, and Patty leans down and holds it in, and then Shorty climbs up. Does that make sense?
Sounds good, Shorty said.
Okay, Carol said. Be ready.
He leaned in the doorway and grabbed the knob and closed the door on them. Through the window, they saw him hustle across the dirt and climb the ladder to the cab. They heard the engine roar and saw the truck jerk into gear and move slowly away, right to left, out of sight. They waited. It didn't come back. They waited. Nothing. No sound. No movement. Nothing out the window except the view as before. The Honda, the lot, the grass, the wall of trees. Shorty said,
"Maybe he got hung up for a minute.
Maybe the assholes came out and started talking to him."
"He's been gone longer than a minute," Patty said.
She put her bags down and stepped closer to the window. She craned her neck and peered out.
"Can't see anything," she said.
Shorty put the suitcase down. He joined her at the window. He said,
"I could go check from the corner. They might see you. They're probably all standing around talking. What else can they be doing? How long does it take to turn a truck around?"
"I'll be careful," Shorty said. He stepped to the door. He turned the knob and pulled. But the door was stuck. It wouldn't move at all. He checked it was properly unlocked from the inside, and he tried the knob both ways. Nothing happened. Patty stared at him. He pulled harder. He put one meaty palm flat on the wall and hauled. Nothing.
"They locked us in,"
Patty said. How? They must have a button in the house. Like remote control. I think they've been messing with it all along. That's completely crazy. What isn't here? They stared out the window. The Honda, the lot, the grass, the wall of trees. Nothing else. Then the window blind motored down in front of them, and the room went dark. Chapter 17. Carol stepped into the back parlor, and the others crowded around and whooped and hooted and slapped him on the back. Stephen ducked away and pattered at a keyboard, and the video on the screens rewound at high speed. Three jerky figures racing around, doing everything fast and backward. He put on a TV voice and said, "Folks, let's go to the action replay, and let's ask the man of the hour how it felt to hit that big grand slam." He changed to forward motion and normal speed. And on the screens, Carol was seen smiling encouragingly and shooing Patty and Shorty toward their door. The audio caught him saying, "Go inside and pack your stuff. This is a 2-minute job." "But it's a swing and a miss," the real Carol said in a TV voice of his own, like a scratchy signal coming in all the way from the Balkans. "The first at bat is a strikeout." On the screens, Patty said, "We packed already." In the parlor, Carol said, "And from that point onward, I was just making it up as I went along. I figured something might happen sooner or later. I knew all I needed to do was maneuver them into the room and close the door. In the end, I got lucky." The others hooted and hollered again, but Mark said, "There was no luck involved. That was a virtuoso performance. We should save this video forever. We should learn it by heart. It was like hearing a maestro play the violin. You've done this before, haven't you, Carol?" The parlor went quiet. On the screens, the video ran on, with the three figures huddled between the Honda and the boardwalk, talking low. Mark said, "You distanced yourself from us by pretending not to be our friend, which purely by default generated a closer bond with them. They fell right into it. They did this to themselves. They became almost intimate. Which you then built on by confirming their worst fears about certain inconsistencies they had noticed. Then you doubled down even more by slowly agreeing to help them escape." It was a masterpiece of emotional manipulation. It was a perfectly constructed roller coaster. They were worried all morning, then suddenly filled with intense hope, which then increased to actual euphoria as they stood there, bags in hand, waiting to go. And now they're suddenly sick with utter defeat. Stephen clicked to a live feed. Patty and Shorty were sitting on their bed in the dark, not moving at all.
"It works better this way," Carol said. "I promise. It's better when they're in touch with their feelings. It marinates their brains. It makes them more fun later. Cross my heart."
Then he said, "I'll see you soon," and walked out the door. Reacher saw the left turn coming up. It was 100 yards ahead. It met the main drag at an oblique angle and curved gently away, as if reluctant. Then it ran onward through apple orchards. He walked on toward it. Halfway there, he had to step up on the grass shoulder to let a giant tow truck blow by. It was huge and bright red and spotlessly clean. It had gold pinstripes all over it. It shook the ground under his feet. He watched it go. Then he walked on again and took the turn. The side road was narrower than the main drag, but wide enough and hard enough for the kind of primitive trucks they might have used long ago, for hauling wood or coal or tin. On either side in the orchards, the apple trees were bending over with heavy fruit. He could smell it in the air. He could smell hot, dry grass. He could hear the buzz of insects. Overhead, a hawk rode the thermals. Then, half a mile after its reluctant turn away from Laconia, the road turned again, as if definitively due west. After that, it ran straight into the distance, through more apple orchards, toward a small, shiny dot, which Reacher figured might be a parked car. Beyond that seemed to be trees of a different green. He walked on. As he got closer, he saw the Dot was indeed a car. Shiny because of the power of the sun, not because of the paint on the car. It looked like a battered old lump. Eventually, he saw it was a Subaru, a little like the one he had ridden in with the contractor with the inspector problem. Genetically related, but 20 years older. Like an ancestor. It was parked head-on against a wooden fence that ran side to side where the blacktop ended. Beyond the fence was another acre of apple orchard, and then another fence, beyond which were wild trees with bigger leaves. There was a guy in the Subaru. He was sitting behind the wheel. Reacher could see the collar of a blue denim jacket and a long gray ponytail. The guy wasn't moving. He was just staring ahead through the windshield. Reacher walked the length of the car on the passenger side and stopped with his back to the guy and his hips against the fence. The next fence was 100 yards away. The trees beyond it looked like regular New England species, densely but randomly scattered, twisted and competing. Which might be what happened when seeds blew in. Also, the fence looked straight. Promising. Behind him, he heard a car door open, and a voice said, "You're the man who talked to Bruce Jones." Reacher turned around and said, "Am I?" The guy from the Subaru was a reedy character, maybe 70 years old. Tall, but cadaverous. Under his jacket, his shoulders looked like a coat hanger. He said, "He showed you the newsletter I wrote." "That was you?" "The very same. He called me. He thought I might be interested that you were interested." "I was, so I came out to meet you."
"How did you know where?"
"You're looking for Ryantown," the guy said.
"Have I found it?"
"Straight ahead."
"Those trees?"
"They thin out in the center. You can see pretty well."
"Sure I won't get poisoned?"
"Tin has the potential to be dangerous. More than 100 milligrams of tin per cubic meter of air is immediately injurious to life and health. What's worse is when tin bonds with certain hydrocarbons to make organotins. Some of those compounds are more lethal than cyanide. That's what I was worried about."
"What happened with that in the end?"
"The chemistry didn't say what it needed to say."
"Even though top scientists were working on it?"
"In the end, the corporation in Colorado banned me from trespassing on what I insisted was their land. They took out a restraining order to keep me away. I can't go beyond this fence."
"Pity," Reacher said. "You could have shown me around."
"What's your name?"
"Reacher." The guy said an address, a street number and a street name, the same name and the same number Reacher had seen in cubicle 4 on the screen from the census when his father was 2.
"It was on the ground floor," the guy said. "Some of the tile is still there, in the kitchen. It was still there 8 years ago, anyway."
"You haven't been back?"
"You can't fight City Hall."
"Who would know?" Reacher said. "Just this once." The guy didn't answer. Reacher said, "Wait." He looked ahead across the 100 yards of orchard to the second fence and the trees beyond. He said, "If that's Ryantown over there, why does the road stop here?"
"It used to go all the way," the guy said. "Technically, the apple farmer is only squatting on this part of his land. About 40 years ago, a cold winter froze the blacktop off, and the next winter broke the base up. So in the spring, the farmer borrowed a bulldozer and planted some more apple trees. Then in the summer, the county came by and fixed what it could see. In the fall, the farmer threw up this fence. And from that point onward, it was a done deal. But good luck ever selling that parcel. The title search won't come back pretty."
"Okay," Reacher said. "Maybe I'll see you later." He hitched up on the fence and swung his legs over and stepped down in the orchard.
"Wait," the guy said. "I'll come with you."
"You sure?"
"Who will know?"
"Live free or die," Reacher said. "I saw it on your license plate."
The guy stepped up on the bottom rail of the fence and from there performed a maneuver similar to Reacher's. They walked together past shiny green eye-level apples, all of them bigger than baseballs, some of them bigger than softballs, stumbling now and then on uneven ground, where maybe 40 years earlier the clandestine winter cleanup had been a little hasty. 100 yards later they arrived at the second fence, where ahead of them were trees of a different kind, not decorous or orderly or smelling sweetly of ripe fruit, but rank weeds, basically. They were thinner and unhealthier dead ahead, because there they were growing through where the old road resumed, without the benefit of either a bulldozer or planting. Therefore, dead ahead would be the practical way in. No machete required, or at least less pushing and shoving. The guy with the ponytail agreed. He was looking at it 8 years later, but it was still the best option. "How long before we see anything?" Reacher asked. "Right away," the guy said. "Look down. You're walking on the old road. Nothing has been done to it, except by nature and weather." Which was plenty. They climbed the fence and pushed through thin trunks and half-hearted bushes, over terrain broken up by 60 years of rain and roots, with cobblestones thrust upward and turned over and rolled aside. Soon they were in an inner ring, like the hole in a donut, where the trees were thin everywhere, because the ground was bad everywhere. The road itself could be traced ahead, curving toward where Reacher could hear water. The stream. Maybe the mill was down there, built next to it, or even over it. The guy with the ponytail started pointing things out. First up on the left was a rectangular foundation the size of a single garage. "The church," the guy said, facing away from everything else, as if from temptation and wickedness. Next up on the right was the same kind of thing, the nub of a stone foundation, just inches high, mostly mossy and covered, crisply enclosing an area of early and vigorous growth, because it had been a crawl space, with no cobblestones or flagstones, or stones of any other kind, just beaten earth, which after a couple of rains was raring to go. This was the schoolroom, the guy said. Better than you might expect. All the kids could read and write. Some of them could think. Teachers were respected then. "Were you a teacher?" Reacher asked. "For a time," the guy said. "In an earlier life." The mill was where the road met the stream. It had been built half in and half out of the water. All that was left was a complex matrix of blocky foundations made of mossy stone, half overgrown by damp riverbank species. One of the foundations was solid and the size of a chimney. One was solid and the size of a room, perhaps to support heavy machinery, cauldrons and crucibles and ladles. The guy showed Reacher a drain in the floor, open to the water below. The workers' housing was across the street, in two buildings laid out in a line. Just the foundations remained. Both would have had a central lobby with stairs, with left-hand and right-hand apartments up and down. 2 4-flats, a total of 8 residences. Ryantown, New Hampshire. Population? Possibly less than 30. The guy said, "The Reacher address would have been the ground floor apartment on the extreme right-hand end, nearest the mill. Traditionally, the foreman lived there. Your grandfather, perhaps." For a time, he graded roads for the county, but his address didn't change. "The mill closed for a couple of years late in the Depression. No point throwing him out in the street. It wasn't like they fired him and needed his house. The mill was idle. It was World War II that got it going again." Reacher looked up at the sky. It was full of bird life. Then, in his mind, he subtracted the new trees and rebuilt the old chimney. And he wondered how it was back in the fall of 1943, with the mill running night and day, and the sky full of smoke. The guy said, "I better get going. I shouldn't be here at all. You stay if you want. I'll wait in the car. I could give you a ride if you like." "Thanks," Reacher said. But don't wait any longer than you want to. I'm always happy to walk. The guy nodded and slipped away through the trees, back the way they had come. Reacher walked over to the right-hand foreflat. Nothing was left of where the shared entrance would have been, except for a stone doorstep. It was wide and deep. It bridged a gutter on the side of the road. The gutter was made from cobblestones laid in a deep U-shaped contour, now mostly broken up and displaced by growth. He stepped over it into the one-time lobby. The floor was cement, broken up by time into random slabs, canted this way and that like ice floes on a winter river. Every split and seam had been colonized by something growing. Nothing remained of the lobby's right-hand wall except for stubs of broken brick, low down at floor level. They looked like teeth smashed down to the gum. In the center was a stone saddle, no taller, but intact. The right-hand ground floor apartment's front door. Reacher stepped inside. The hallway floor had three trees growing through it. Their trunks were no thicker than his wrist, but they had raced 20 feet high, looking for light. Beyond them, and either side, were low lines of smashed brick, showing where the rooms had been, like an architect's floor plan come to life, slightly three-dimensional. Two bedrooms, he thought, plus a living room and a dine-in kitchen. All small. Mean and pinched by modern standards. No bathroom. Maybe out back. The surviving patch of tile was on a tipped-up slab of what must have been the kitchen floor. It looked like a standard old-fashioned commercial product, and the cement under it looked crusty and full of air. But it had clung on by some miracle of adhesive chemistry. The pattern in the tile was faded and washed out by 60 years of exposure. But it looked like once upon a time it had been some kind of a late Victorian riot of bright, tangled colors, with acanthus leaves and marigolds and artichoke blossoms. Reacher imagined it close up, from a kid's point of view, crawling around, with the colors bobbing in and out of focus. As he remembered it, the only color Stan had grown up to care about was olive drab. Maybe why? He left by squeezing past the hallway trees again and going out through the lobby. Which was pointless, because he could have stepped out of the building anywhere he chose. No wall was more than 4 inches high. But he wanted to feel he was retracing steps. He paused at the street door, which wasn't there, and sat down on the step, which still was, like a kid might, maybe after a rainstorm, with the gutter running like a river under his feet. Then he heard a sound, way off to his right. It was a yelp, a man's voice, definitely not joy or ecstasy, not really outrage or anger either, just pain, distant, about where the orchard was on the way back to the car. Reacher stood up and picked his way over the heaved and tumbled stones as fast as he could, slipping between trees, following the old road, past the schoolroom, past the church, back to the fence. Where 50 yards away he saw the old guy with the ponytail, exactly halfway across the orchard. Another guy less than half his age and maybe twice his weight was standing behind him, twisting his arms. Reacher stepped over the fence and set out toward them. Chapter 18. 50 yards would have been 5 or 6 seconds for an athlete, but Reacher was aiming nearer 30. A slow walk, but purposeful, intended to communicate something. He kept his strides long and his shoulders loose and his hands away from his sides. He kept his head up and his eyes hard on the guy. A primitive signal, learned long ago. The guy glanced away to the south. For help, maybe. Maybe he wasn't alone. Reacher got close. The big guy turned to face him. He wrestled the old guy around in front and used him like a human shield. Reacher stopped, 6 feet away. He said, "Let him go." Just 3 words. But in a tone also learned long ago, with whole extra paragraphs hidden in the dying vowel sound at the end of the phrase, about the inevitable and catastrophic result of attempted resistance. The big guy let the old guy go. But he wasn't quitting. No, sir. He wanted Reacher to be sure about that. He made it like he wanted to free up his hands anyway, for more important purposes. He shoved the old guy aside and stepped right into Reacher's space, not more than 4 feet away. He was 20-some years old, dark-haired and unshaven, more than 6 feet and 200 pounds, tanned and muscled by outdoor labor. He said, "This is none of your business." Reacher thought, "What is this? Groundhog Day?" But out loud he said, "You were committing a crime on public land. I would be failing in my duty as a citizen if I didn't point it out. That's how civilization works." The guy glanced away to the south and back again. He said, "This ain't public land. This is my granddaddy's apple farm, and neither of you should be here. Him, because he ain't allowed, and you, because you're trespassing." "This is the road," Reacher said. "Your granddaddy stole it from the county 40 years ago, back when he was a brave young fellow, like you are now." The guy glanced south again, but this time he didn't glance back. Reacher turned and saw another guy approaching, walking fast between two lines of trees where the orchard came down a slope. He looked the same as the first guy, except a generation older. Not more. The daddy, perhaps. Not the granddaddy. Better jeans than his son. Cleaner t-shirt. Deeper tan. Grayer hair. Built the same. But 50-something. He arrived and said, "What's going on here?" Reacher said, "You tell me." "Who are you?" "Just a guy standing on the public road asking you a question." "This is not the public road." That's the problem with denial. Reality doesn't care what you think. It just keeps rolling along. This is the road. Always was. Still is. "What's your question?" "I saw your boy physically assaulting this much older gentleman. I guess my question is how well you think that reflects on your parenting skills."
"In this case, pretty damn well," the new guy said. "What are our apples worth if people think our water is poisoned?"
"That all was 8 years ago," Reacher said. "It came to nothing anyway. The top scientists in the world said your water is okay. So get over it, with a little humility."
"Probably you said some dumb thing 8 years ago. Should I twist your arm today?"
The old guy with the ponytail said, "Technically they have a contract with the corporation in Colorado. There was a rider on the restraining order. It said they get paid if they can prove I was here. I hoped they had forgotten the arrangement. Apparently they hadn't. They saw my car."
"How do they prove it?"
"They just did. They texted a picture. That's where he went. No cell signal, except up on the rise."
"Law and order," the daddy said. "It's what this country needs. Except for the part about stealing the county road to grow more apples. I'm getting sick of hearing you say that over and over.
It's the sound of reality, rolling along."
"Why were you in the woods anyway?"
"None of your business," Reacher said.
"Maybe it is our business. We have a relationship with the landowner."
"You can't text a picture of me."
"Why not?"
"You would have to take your phone out of your pocket, whereupon I would take it away from you and break it. I guess that's why you can't.
There are two of us. Two phones.
Still not enough. You should call for reinforcements. But oh dear, you can't. No cell signal, except up on the rise."
"You're a cocky son of a bitch, aren't you?"
"I prefer realistic," Reacher said.
"Want to put it to the test?"
"I would have an ethical dilemma. It might scar the boy for life to see his daddy laid out in front of him. Equally, it might scar you to see your boy laid out. After being unable to protect him, I mean. You might feel bad about that. I believe it's a parenting thing. I wouldn't know for sure. I'm not a father myself. But I can imagine. The guy didn't reply. Reacher said, "Wait." He looked south, between the two lines of trees, where the orchard came down the slope. "You were on your way back," he said. "The text was already sent from the top of the hill. The photograph must have been taken some moments before that. So why was our mutual friend still here with his arms behind his back?" No answer. The guy with the ponytail said, "I was to get a beating, so I would learn my lesson. Just as soon as the text was sent and their money was guaranteed. At that point, they didn't know you were in the woods, too." "That shouldn't really make a difference," Reacher said. "Should it? Not to men of conviction, surely." He looked at the daddy, and then at the son, full in the eye. He said, "Time is wasting, guys. Go ahead and give him his beating." No one moved. Reacher looked at the young guy. He said, "It's okay. He won't hurt you. He's 70 years old. You could push him over with a feather. He's nothing to be scared of." The guy moved his head, like a dog sniffing the air. "It's a binary choice now," Reacher said. "Either you hit him, or you're scared of him." No response. "Or maybe it's conscience trouble. Maybe that's it. You don't want to hit an old guy. You really don't. But hey, think about the apples. You have a job to do. I get it. In fact, I could help you out. You could give me a beating first. That way you would feel you had earned it when you start in on the old guy. It might make you feel less troubled." No response. "Why not?" Reacher said. "You scared of me, too? Scared I'm going to hurt you? I have to tell you, it's a possibility. Full disclosure. You need to make an informed decision. Because now it really is a binary choice. Either you hit me, or you're scared of me." No answer. Reacher stepped in close. The opposite of risky. Better to crowd him. If the kid was dumb enough to throw a punch, it was better to smother it early, before it had speed and development and direction. Which would be easy enough. If the kid was dumb enough. Reacher was 30 pounds heavier and 3 inches taller, and probably 5 inches longer in the arm. That much was visible. The kid was dumb enough. His shoulder jerked back in what Reacher took to be the early warning stages of what was no doubt intended to be a short, clubbing right to his face, which gave him a choice. Either instantaneous reaction, involving a wide, outward-sweeping gesture with his left forearm, designed to deflect the incoming short right, while his own short right crashed home, which would be, in any realistic sense, the best move to make. It would be fast, hard, and elegantly abrupt. But it wouldn't be forensic. Reacher felt like he was in front of a jury, like he was giving evidence, or being asked to explain it, like an expert witness. He felt in order to be effective, he should let the narrative unspool a little longer than an instant. A crime required both intent and action, and he felt he should let both components become plainly visible, all the way to where they were provable beyond a reasonable doubt. So he jerked his head sideways and let the short right fizz past his ear in all its glory. A big punch now, right there for every eye to see, unmistakable, obvious in its intent. And then he waited for the kid to drag his fist back unrequited. And then he waited again, for what felt to him like a very long interval, purely to allow adequate time for jury room deliberations. And then he hit the kid under the chin with a solid right-hand uppercut. The kid went up weightless in his boots, and then collapsed backward on the grass with a bristly thump, with all kinds of dust and pollen puffing up in the sunshine. The kid's limbs went slack, and his head lolled to the side. Reacher gave the guy with the ponytail a let's-go nod. Then he looked at the kid's daddy. "Parenting tip," he said. "Don't leave him lying in the road. He could get run over." "I won't forget this." "That's the difference between us," Reacher said. "I already have." He caught up to the old guy, and they walked the second 50 yards together, back to the ancient Subaru. Eventually, Patty got up off the bed. She walked to the door where the light switch was. 3 steps. Through the first, she was certain the power would still be on. Through the second, she was sure it would be off. If they could lock the door and shade the window by remote control, surely they could kill the electricity. Then she changed her mind again. Why would they? Through the third step, she was once again convinced it would be on. Because of the meals. Why would they give them meals and then expect them to eat in the dark? Then she remembered the flashlights. What were they for? She remembered Shorty's comment, in case you have to eat in the dark. Maybe not so dumb. She tried the switch. It worked. The lights came on, hot and yellow. She hated electric light in the daytime. She tried the door, still locked. She tried the buttons for the window blind. Nothing. Shorty sat still in the brassy glare and watched her. She turned and looked all around the room, at the furniture, at their bags, still where they had dropped them when the truck didn't come back, at the walls and the slim molding where they met the ceiling, at the ceiling itself. It was a snowy expanse of perfectly smooth, old-fashioned New England white, containing nothing except a smoke alarm and a bulkhead light, both above the bed. Shorty said, "What?" Patty looked back at their bags. She said, "How well were they hidden?" "Where?" "In the hedge, Shorty." "Pretty well," he said. "The big one is heavy. It squashed right down, you saw." And then Peter got lucky and got his truck started and took it down the track to warm it up. There and back, real quick. Yet he had time to spot our luggage. Maybe it was his headlights as he turned. Maybe it was more visible from behind. It was on the right. He would have turned counterclockwise. Different view than you got with the flashlight. You checked from the road. He had time to make a rope handle. Shorty said nothing. "Using rope he just happened to have with him," she said. "What are you thinking?" "There were other things, too," she said. "We made fun of Carol for saying he might get lucky with a wreck, and then he said it right back to us, practically the first thing out of his mouth, in the back of the junkyard. Maybe he says it a lot." "Why did they make a rope handle?"
"I thought they were maybe helping us."
"Are you kidding?" "I suppose. I didn't understand it." "They were taunting us."
"Were they?"
"We talked about getting a rope to make a handle. So that's exactly what they did. They got a rope and made a handle. To demonstrate their power. And to show us how they're secretly laughing up their sleeves at us. How could they know what we talked about?"
"They're listening to us," Patty said. "There's a microphone in this room."
"That's crazy. You got another explanation?"
"Where is it?"
"Maybe in the light." They both squinted at it, hot and yellow. Shorty said, "Mostly we talked outside, in the chairs."
"Then there must be a microphone out there, too. That's how Peter found our luggage. They heard us talking about where to put it.
They heard the whole plan. Back and forth with the damn quad bike, which is why Mark said we must be tired. Which was a weird remark otherwise, but he knew what we had been doing, because we told him ahead of time."
"What else did we say?"
"Lots of things. You said maybe Canadian cars are different, and the next thing we hear is, hey, Canadian cars are different. They were listening all along."
"What else?"
"Doesn't matter what else. What else we said is not what matters. What matters is what we say next."
"Which is what?"
"Nothing," Patty said. "We can't even plan what to do. Because they'll hear us."
Chapter 19 Reacher and the guy with the ponytail climbed the fence and walked to the Subaru. The guy said, "You were pretty rough back there." "Not really," Reacher said. "I hit him once. There is no smaller number. It was the irreducible minimum. It was almost kind-hearted. I assume he has a dental plan.
His father meant what he said. He won't forget. That family has a reputation to keep up. They'll have to do something.
Reacher stared at him. Deja vu all over again. The guy said,
they think they're top dogs around here. They'll worry that word will get out. They won't want people laughing at them behind their backs. So they'll have to come looking for you.
Who? Reacher said. The granddad?
They offer a lot of seasonal work. They get a lot of loyalty in exchange.
How much more do you know about Ryantown? The guy paused a beat. He said,
there's an old man you should talk to. I was debating whether to mention him at all, because honestly, I think you should get going instead.
Pursued by a large and hostile crowd of fruit pickers? These are not pleasant people. How bad can they be?
You should get going.
Where is the old man I should talk to?
You couldn't see him before tomorrow. It would have to be arranged.
How old is he?
I guess more than 90 now.
From Ryantown originally?
His cousins were. He spent time there.
Does he remember people?
He claims to. I interviewed him about the tin. I asked him about kids who got sick. He came up with a list of names, but they were just regular childhood ailments. Nothing conclusive.
That was 8 years ago. Maybe his memory got worse.
Possible.
Why tomorrow?
He's in a home, deep in the countryside. Visiting hours are limited.
I would need a motel tonight.
You should go to Laconia. It would be safer. More people around. It would be harder to find.
Maybe I prefer the rural ambiance.
There's a place 20 miles north of here. It's supposed to be good, but maybe not for you. It's deep in the woods. No bus. Too far to walk. You would be much better off in Laconia.
Reacher said nothing.
The guy said, better still if you moved on altogether. I could drive you somewhere if you like, as a way of saying thank you for rescuing me back there.
That was my fault anyway, Reacher said. I persuaded you to come. I got you in trouble.
I would still drive you somewhere.
Drive me to Laconia, Reacher said. Then make the arrangements with the old guy. Reacher got out on a downtown corner, and the guy with the ponytail drove away. Reacher looked left and right and got his bearings. He smiled. He was halfway between where two separate 20-year-olds had been discovered unconscious on the sidewalk, 75 years apart. He checked the passers-by. There were a few folks who could have been up from Boston, but none of them looked wrong. Couples, mostly. Some gray hair. Shoppers, probably, looking for end-of-season bargains on whatever it was Laconia had to offer. Nothing suspicious. Not yet. Tomorrow, Shaw had said. The chief of detectives. He should know. Reacher took a side street where he had seen an inn. No better or worse than all the others. It was another narrow 3-floor building, painted an artful faded color. He paid for a room and went up to take a look at it. The window faced out back, which he was happy about. It decreased the effective radius. He might get a quiet night. A raccoon or a coyote, maybe, looking for trash in the alley. Or a neighbor's dog. But nothing worse. Then he went out again, because it was still full daylight. He was hungry. He had skipped lunch. He should have been eating it about the time he was gazing at the fragment of old kitchen tile. All that remained. Not a large room. Probably not well equipped. Therefore, a simple menu for lunch. Peanut butter, maybe. Or grilled cheese. Or something out of a can. A tin can. He found a coffee shop a block away which offered all-day breakfast, which in his experience usually implied all-day everything. He went inside. There were five booths. Four were occupied. The first three by what looked like out-of-town shoppers refreshing themselves after an exhausting spree. And the fourth by a familiar face. Detective Brenda Amos. She was deep in a salad. No doubt a long-awaited meal much delayed by ongoing chaos. Reacher had been a cop. He knew what it was like. Running here, running there. Phones ringing. Eat when you can. Sleep when you can. She looked up. At first she looked surprised, just for a second. And then she looked dismayed. He shrugged and sat down on the bench across from her. He said, "Shaw told me I'm legal until tomorrow." She said, "He told me you agreed to move on. If I found Ryantown. Didn't you? Apparently there's a guy I should talk to. A very old man. Same age my father would be. An exact contemporary. Are you going to talk to him today? Tomorrow." "This is exactly what we were afraid of. You're going to be here forever. Look on the bright side. Maybe no one is coming. The kid was an asshole. Maybe they think he deserved it. Tough love, or whatever they call it now. No chance whatsoever." The very old man I should talk to had cousins in Ryantown. He used to visit on a regular basis. Maybe they all got up a game in the street, all the neighborhood kids, stickball or whatever. Maybe they played catch across the stream. With all due respect, Major, do you really care about that stuff? "I guess a little bit," Reacher said. "Enough to stick around one more night, anyway. We don't want trouble here. Always best avoided. They have the rest of the day to plan. They'll mobilize before midnight. They'll be here by morning. The distances are not great. They'll have your description with them. Therefore, Shaw is going to dial it up to 11 before first light. He's going to treat this place like a war zone. Where does this very old man live?" "In a home somewhere out of town. A guy I met is going to pick me up." "What guy?" 8 years ago, he thought the water was contaminated." "Was it?" "Apparently not. It's a sore point." "Where is he going to pick you up?"
"Where he let me out."
"At an agreed-upon time?"
9:30 on the dot. Something about visiting hours."
Amos paused a beat.
"Okay," she said. "You're authorized to do that. But you'll do it my way. You don't leave your room at any point. No one ever sees you. And at 9:30 in the morning exactly, you run straight to the car with your head down. And you drive away. And you don't come back. That's the deal I'm offering. Or we run you out now."
"I already paid for my room," Reacher said. "Running me out now would be an injustice."
"I'm serious," she said. "This is not the OK Corral. This is collateral damage just waiting to happen. If they miss you, they'll hit two other people instead. Watch my lips. We are not going to allow drive-by shootings in our town. No way. This is Laconia, not Los Angeles. And with respect, Major, you should support our position. You should know better than to put innocent bystanders at risk."
"Relax," Reacher said. "I support your position. I support it big time. I'll do everything your way. I promise. Starting tomorrow. Today, I'm still legal."
"Start when it gets dark tonight," Amos said. "Play it safe. For my sake."
She took out a business card and handed it to him. She said, "Call me if you need me."
Chapter 20. Patty took off her shoes, because she was Canadian, and stepped up on the bed and stood upright on the bouncy surface. She shuffled sideways and tilted her face up toward the light. She said loudly, "Please raise the window blind. As a personal favor to me, I want to see daylight. What possible harm could it do? No one ever comes here." Then she climbed down and sat on the edge of the mattress to put her shoes back on. Shorty watched the window, like he was watching a ball game on a television screen. The same kind of close attention,
The blind stayed down. He shrugged. "Good try," he mouthed, silently. "They're discussing it," she mouthed back. They waited again. And then the blind rolled up. The motor whirred, and a blue bar of bright afternoon light came spilling in, narrow at first, but widening all the time, until it filled the room with sunshine. Patty glanced up at the ceiling. "Thank you," she said. She walked to the door to kill the hot yellow bulb. 3 steps. The first felt good, because she liked the daylight. The second felt better, because she had made them do something for her. She had established a line of communication. She had made them understand she was a person. But then the third step felt worse again, because she realized she had given them leverage. She had told them what she feared to lose. She put her elbows on the sill and her forehead on the glass and stared out at the view. It was unchanged. The Honda, the lot, the grass, the wall of trees. Nothing else. In the back parlor over at the house, Mark finished a phone call and put the receiver down. He checked the screens. Patty was happy. He turned to face the others. "Listen up," he said. "That was a neighbor on the phone. Some old apple farmer 20 miles south of here. They had a guy there today making trouble. They want us to keep an eye out for him. In case he happens to come by looking for a room, they'll send folks up to get him. Apparently they need to teach him a lesson." "He won't come by," Peter said. "We took the signs down." "The apple farmer said this was a big, rough guy." "Which is exactly what our friend at the county office said, too, about a big rough guy named Reacher, who was researching his family history, who looked at 4 separate censuses, at least 2 of which must have had a Ryantown address, which is a place where theoretically I had distant relatives, and which is a place right there in the corner of the apple farm in question. This guy is mapping out Reacher real estate. He's going from parcel to parcel. He must be some kind of mad hobbyist. You think he'll come here?" "My grandfather's name is still on the deed. But that was after Ryantown. It was after they got rich." "We don't need this now," Robert said. "We have bigger fish to fry. The first arrival is less than 12 hours away." "He won't come here," Mark said. "He must be a different branch of the family. I never heard about anyone like that. He'll stick to his own lineage. Surely. Everyone does. No reason why he would come here. We just rolled their blind up." "Leave it up," Mark said. "He won't come here. They could signal for help. Watch the track and listen for the bell. Why would we need to if he won't come here?" "Because someone else might. Anyone could. We need maximum vigilance now. Because this is where we earn it, guys. Attention to detail today pays dividends tomorrow." Stephen switched out the screens either side of center to 2 alternate views of the mouth of the track, where it came out of the trees, 1 close up, 1 wide angle. Nothing was moving. Reacher did it Amos's way. He went back to his room and holed up for the rest of the afternoon. No one saw him, which was good. Except dinner was going to be a problem. The place he had picked to stay was just a bijou little inn. There was no room service. Probably no catering at all, except brought in muffins for the breakfast buffet. Free, in the lobby. But not yet. Not for another 12 hours at the earliest. Probably closer to 14. A person could starve to death. He looked out the window, which was a waste of time because it showed him nothing but the back of the next street. But he knew the place with the all-day breakfast was only a block away. If he went there, who would see him? Maximum 2 or 3 passers-by on a single downtown block in a town like Laconia at sundown. Plus the customers in the coffee shop. Plus the waitstaff, who had already seen him once at lunchtime, not long before, which was not good. Yes, they could say, He's in here all the time. He's practically a regular. Which would then focus any subsequent search on the immediate neighborhood. The Bijou Inn with the faded colors would be target number one. Front and center. The obvious location. Perhaps worthy of an immediate visit. Maybe first thing in the morning, before a civilized person was up and about. Not good. Better to go further afield. He turned away from the window and made a mental map in his head of what he had seen so far. His first hotel, the city office, the county office, the police station, his second hotel, and all the establishments in between, where he had eaten and gotten coffee and window shopped for shoes and bags and cookware. For dinner, he wanted a place he hadn't been before. He figured two sightings were 10 times worse than one. Call it a rule. Always better to be a first-time stranger. He recalled a particular single-wide storefront bistro, with a half-curtained window and old-fashioned light bulbs inside, like glowing tangles of heated wire. Probably a small staff, and a small and discreet clientele. He had passed it by, but not gone in. 6 blocks away, he thought. Or 7. Which was more than ideal, but he figured he could zigzag through the side streets. Which would be quieter. Safe enough. He went downstairs and stepped out to the fading light and set out walking. His mental map worked well enough. One time he hesitated, but in the end he guessed right. The bistro came up dead ahead. 8 blocks out, not 7 or 6. Further than he thought. He had been exposed a long time. He had counted 18 passers-by. Not all of them had seen him, but some had. No one suspicious. All regular folk. On the sidewalk outside the bistro, he stood up tall on tiptoes, so he could see inside over the half-curtain, so he could make an assessment. He had no real taste in food. Anything would do. But he liked a corner table with his back to the wall, and a little hustle, but not too much, and a few other customers, but not too many. Whatever it took to be served fast and not remembered. The place looked like it would fit the bill. There was an empty two-top in the far rear corner. The waitresses looked brisk and on the ball. The room was about half full. 6 people eating. All good. Ideal in every way. Except that 2 of the 6 people eating were Elizabeth Castle and Carter Carrington. A second date. Possibly delicate. He didn't want to ruin their evening. They would feel obliged to ask him to join them at their table. Saying no wouldn't help. Then he would be eating 2 tables away, and they would feel self-conscious and scrutinized. The whole atmosphere would feel weird and strained and artificial. But he owed Amos. She was out on a limb. You don't leave your room at any point. No one ever sees you. How much more walking around could he afford to do? In the end, the decision made itself. For some reason, Elizabeth Castle looked up. She saw him. Her mouth opened in a little O of surprise, which then changed instantly to a smile, which looked totally genuine, and then she waved. At first, just an excited greeting, but then an eager, come in and join us gesture. He went in. At that point, it was the path of least resistance. He crossed the room. Carrington stood up to shake hands, courteous, a little old-fashioned. Elizabeth Castle leaned across and scraped out a 3rd chair. Carrington held out his palm toward it, like a maitre d', and said, please. Reacher sat down, his back to the door, facing a wall. The path of least resistance. He said, I don't want to wreck your evening. Elizabeth Castle said, don't be silly. Then, congratulations.